Good morning and welcome to the Mr. Elfin Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Mottram. It is Thursday, June 25th. We're normally a Redskins-oriented podcast, but today we're going to talk about something different. Here to do that with me, it's the 2020 Dwayne Haskins body type to my 2019 Dwayne Haskins body type, Matt Turrell. Hey, Matt.
Hi, Jamie. I really think you got that one backwards.
I don't know. I haven't seen you in a while. I don't know if you've added or subtracted from your body mass during this pandemic.
I assure you, I am and always will be substantially doughier than you are.
the always doughy Matt Turrell. We're not going to talk about the Redskins, even though this is kind of a Redskins podcast. But before we move past that, is there anything about the Redskins you wanted to mention?
I mean, do we want to talk about the George Preston Marshall stuff? Do we want to put a pin in it and talk about it later? Or do we want to just ignore it altogether?
I feel like the only thing I'd want to talk about right now is the potential for a name change, but that's just a dead horse. I am excited about the sexiness of Dwayne Haskins these days, and also Chase Young. There's a lot of sexiness happening on social media.
There really is. I mean, and that's tremendous because social media is all we're going to have. There's not going to be a football season. So, yeah, let's move on.
Good point. Okay, so dear listeners who were with us in fall 2019 during that abomination of a Redskins season, thank you for sticking with us. Probably heard towards the end of some of the episodes when we start talking about pop culture and what we're watching, listening to, whatever, that you, Matt, were very, very excited and just rave reviews for the show Watchmen on HBO. I believe you called it the greatest show of all time.
I don't specifically remember saying it, but it certainly fits with what I think. So yes, I'm going to double down on it.
I feel like you said that, and that really like blew my hair back at one point.
I don't listen to the show. So.
You don't listen back. But I did not have HBO at the time, and I still don't have HBO, so I wasn't watching. And I do enjoy peak TV, you know? I mean, I just, like a lot of people, you know, I like Mad Men and Breaking Bad and Game of Thrones and on and on. Like, I felt like I was really missing out on Watchmen. Even if I don't think just as like a outsider who wasn't watching it, I don't think it got to that level of like kind of general acknowledgement, but hearing you kind of vouch for it in that way made me really feel like I was missing out.
I feel so powerful.
I know, you do, hear like Dr. Manhattan of this shit. So I also though didn't know what I was missing out on because I never read the graphic novel. I still haven't. I never saw the Watchmen movie from 10 years ago. Still haven't. And generally don't like comic book superhero stuff. So, you know, I didn't really know what I was missing out on. And then this past weekend, I'll get to the point of this podcast. This past weekend, amidst, you know, all of the, you know, civil unrest, in the wake of the killing of George Floyd, HBO decided to make the season, or the series, I guess, I don't know if it's a series or it's a season, but it's 9 episodes of season 1 of Watchmen, was available on HBO all this past weekend. For 3 days, it was free. And I watched all 9 episodes in 3 days. I did 3 straight nights of 3 hours a night by myself because my wife didn't care. and binged the shit out of the Watchmen like I have not binged a show in a very long time, if ever. So here we are to talk about that.
And so I did not realize your wife did not watch it with you. That's interesting. So when I watched it the first time, my wife did not watch with me, but I happened to have just completed a rewatch because she wanted to watch it.
Oh, wow.
So,
okay.
So I have sat through it again and should remember most things and not do that awkward podcast thing where you're like vaguely, you know, that guy and the stuff and the thing.
Yeah.
What was delaying her was she was trying to read the graphic novel, but it's a time consumer. It's not exactly like a breezy read. And So eventually she reached the point where she was like, look, I want to watch the show. Do you want to just summarize it for me? And I said, instead of summarizing it for you, what we'll do is we'll watch Zack Snyder's 2009, I think, movie. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you where it diverges. And that way you'll at least have context for the important, not important, but the things in the show that directly reference the earlier story. And I want to make this very clear. That movie is an abomination in the eyes of God. It is horrible. So I just want to, I'm aware of that. I know that. My wife, I think, retroactively understands that, but it was effective. It did what we needed it to do.
So I watched the show with no context whatsoever. I mean, nothing. And that left me scratching my head at some points, but I also had faith that like all would be revealed and that like the show would kind of help me out at some points. And it did. Like by the end, I didn't really feel like I didn't understand things. I felt like maybe I was missing out on some stuff. But I will say before we get to like spoilers, so like, you know, if you're listening and you haven't watched the show and you plan on, you know, doing that, we are going to spoil the shit out of it. But before we do that, I just want to say, if you're on the fence about the show, just watch the first episode, the first like 10, 15 minutes, and you will be so far in, you'll have no choice but to keep going.
I would agree with that. So you came away positive about it. Is that safe to say?
Yes, very safe to say.
Okay. I'm curious. I don't even know how to approach the conversation. I literally can't imagine watching it without the context. Because, I mean, so to give some very high-level sort of context, if anybody for some reason doesn't know, maybe you. I don't know. The original graphic novel was published in 12 issues in 1986, written by Alan Moore, drawn by Dave Gibbons. It is widely viewed as one of the sort of most successful uses of sort of the mainstream graphic novel form. It was 1986, so they're sort of deconstructing the superhero iconography, but they're doing it in this very formalist way. They used sort of a recurring structure, so every page has 9 evenly sized panels on it, and if they break that, they break it in such a way that it's within the structure, so it lets them sort of control the timing. It's a very sort of like, it's a work that's designed to be reread and analyzed, and then the show really tries to echo a lot of those sort of approaches and motifs. And it Damon Lindelof, who was the showrunner and I think main producer, I don't know exactly what his title was, I don't remember, kept saying that this isn't it's a remix of Watchmen, it's not a remake, it's a sequel. I mean, it's a straight up sequel to the graphic novel. So I'm curious, I'm very curious to hear what it was like watching it with none of that context, because to me it was almost 85% context.
Well, I will say that I enjoyed the first few episodes, especially, you know, like maybe the I enjoyed the beginning more than like the middle and the end, which I knew like something was kind of amiss, because you had said like the episodes, like, I don't know, whatever, 5 through 8 are like the high level, like masterful episodes. And for me, it was more like the beginning. And maybe that's because I feel like the show, as it went on, got more and more into the backstory and like the kind of the Watchmen and / Minutemen esque, you know, those characters and their stories.
I suspect you're right.
Like when it starts, like it's, you're kind of like, you're at the very beginning, like you're set in Tulsa, 1921, you know, with the massacre on Black Wall Street. And then it leaps forward to like Tulsa now, or some version of now. That is sort of recognizable, although there's all these like aspects of it that are a little off kilter, like the cops are wearing masks. From the very beginning, like the immediacy of the white guy driving a pickup truck getting pulled over by a black officer, and the white guy's doing all the telltale signs of like what you would expect a black man to be doing, like hands on the wheel, very respectful of the officer. You know, informing the officer, I'm going to reach for the glove box. You know, there's no gun in there. All that stuff. You know, so you're a little bit like, okay, this is a version of now that is unreal, but recognizable. And then it sort of like devolves from there, you know, into like, and I don't mean like it's diminished. I just mean like it becomes like more, you know, comic book, more fictional, you know, where you learn of this Dr. Manhattan figure who's on Mars, you know, you're suddenly like, oh, okay, this is kind of like the superhero nature of this that I, you know, was maybe expecting. That stuff didn't really come in really heavy, I don't think, until more of like the middle third.
I think you're correct. I think we are moving towards the point of spoilers. So just if anybody really does care, heads up. Mm-hmm. You're the second person to say that to me this week. Somebody else who had read the comics had the same reaction. And I think their feeling sort of was that it was that back half that turns into more of the sequel. And the first half mm-hmm. is where more of the interesting ideas are front loaded, which makes me, you know, squares with what I just said about how to me it was 85%, you know, backstory and mm-hmm. what you bring to it.
And there was enough, they kind of told you enough of like the backstory. Like there was this event in New York in 1985 where 3 million people died and, you know, kind of ended the Cold War or what have you. I might be butchering this, but like, that was enough for me. Like, I didn't need to know all of the beats of that story to kind of know enough to understand this story or to at least enjoy this story, you know? So like, I felt like there was a backstory that was obscured to me, but it was okay. Like it taught me enough along the way so that I could at least enjoy this story.
Well, and it's interesting. I hadn't thought of this before, but so the structure of the original graphic novel, the story therein is roughly as follows. It opens with a murder mystery, much like this one does. It's the death mm-hmm. of a guy who turns out to have been one of these masked men, sort of government-sponsored mm-hmm. superhero. And they're in the course of investigating the murder, it escalates by the end and turns out to be part of this grand conspiracy, which leads to what you... we're in the aftermath of here. It leads to this superhero deciding to end the Cold War by faking an alien invasion, but faking it so realistically that he in fact teleports a giant mutated squid into the middle of New York, and it creates psychic shockwaves and it kills a bunch of people and drives a bunch of people crazy. But it in the end, the graphic novel ends with the question of, in the end, was it all worth it? And Dr. Manhattan says to him, as he repeats multiple times in this one, nothing ever ends. Okay, so uh-huh. That's where that portion of the story concludes. And so it's actually the same structure again. It's that sort of build up from street level to this like wonky craziness that I hadn't realized that yes, they are totally mirroring in this version. So.
That's interesting too, because this one sort of ends. I love the ending, and I would be fine if there was no continuation.
I 100%
agree. But there totally could be. Like, obviously, the way that it ended, there could be another story.
Did you you texted me the other day or something, I don't remember, but we communicated the other day, and you were like, mm-hmm. It's time for me to go, you know, listen to all the podcasts and read all the writing about it. You know, that point that you reach after mm-hmm. you binge a series that's been out. Did you do it?
Yeah. Not really. I did I listened a little bit to The Watch, an episode that they did after the finale, but you know, like all the other ones, you know, like whether it was The Watch or like what's the one you recommended, like Boars, Gore and Swords or something like that. Yeah. It was just too much because like it's too much to listen back after you've already watched the full season. This is my regret. My deep regret, and I think it would have been a much richer experience, is that if I had watched this as it aired, one episode per week, and like listened to a podcast or read a recap or whatever, and really like sat down at the smorgasbord of Watchmen content as it was unfolding, I would have understood it a lot more. I think it would have been a much richer experience. And this is like sort of the perfect show to do that with.
Agreed. And the first episode, especially. So this gets a little in the weeds in two places. I'll try to go really quickly. The original Watchmen, as I said, was written by Alan Moore and drawn by Dave Gibbons. They did it using new superheroes. They created new superheroes for it, but based on older ones that had sort of been out of print for a long time. And the original plan was to use the older characters. And the more they worked with it, the more they said, well, hey, let's use our own, you know, it'll be sort of thinly veiled versions. They would never made any secret of that, but it'll be our own. And so when they published it through DC Comics, who publishes Superman and Batman and those things, the deal was that as long as it remained continuously in print, the rights would be with DC Comics. But as soon as it went out of print for some length of time, I think a year, the rights would revert to Moore and Gibbons because it was characters that they had created. And you know, there's this whole history in the comics industry of like, Stan Lee gets like very little for his contributions. Jack Kirby, who arguably contributed more, gets even less. Like, there's a long history of creators getting screwed over. So this in 1986 was seen as like a real achievement for creators' rights, except that then the collected edition became the first comic book collection to remain continuously in print for what we are now on, whatever, 35, whatever years now, and the rights have never reverted. So it's very contentious. Alan Moore feels as though he was cheated. So as this show is coming out, there's a lot of people who are in fact huge fans of the property who, instead of being excited for it, feel that it's a betrayal, feel that it's, there's all these reasons they don't want to see it. Okay. So you've got that. Also the comic, Alan Moore is a British guy. Dave Gibbons, also British, comic written in 1986 in the mainstream comic book industry, is exceptionally white. It is, you know, you don't notice it when you read it because systemic racism and ingrained prejudices, but looking back on it and just thinking like, hey, where are people of color in this? The answer is like, there's a psychiatrist who is a black guy. And
that is so strange that it's like a such a white story given the nature of this show.
So
it deals so deeply in race. Like that's the story.
Exactly. So the first episode airs and comic book Twitter, you know, loses their minds and they're like, oh my God, it's so rich. It's so deep. It's such a, you know, continuation. But what nobody, except I presume for the creators and HBO, knew was coming is that Black Twitter loses their minds. And, you know, Black Twitter is like a really activated, energized, you know, enthusiastic group when they get behind something. And it was weird for me seeing those two Twitters sort of like suddenly intersect and overlap and seeing what I'm saying is, yes, you are correct. It was a really good one to be following with online. It was also interesting because you said you didn't feel like it hit as big as the other ones. And it definitely didn't. I mean, it wasn't Game of Thrones. It wasn't Breaking Bad, but
it didn't feel like a big HBO. It felt like a Westworld level.
Yes.
Maybe.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But if you were following certain Twitter bubbles or you expanded to follow certain Twitter bubbles, it was like every Sunday night, just everybody lost their freaking minds. So that's the context. And that's also the context for why the reveal in the flashback of who Hooded Justice is was so much more seismic to somebody who has sort of read and liked, but always been, you know, become aware of the problems with the comic, because that was not what was intended at the time. They left Hooded Justice's identity a mystery, but the reveal in the show like drastically retroactively changes the comic in like a great, great, great way.
Because it's basically like a Hooded Justice episode.
Yes.
Within the series. And I didn't even know if Hooded Justice was a character that existed before that moment.
So Hooded Justice is like this. So the comic is.
But you didn't need to. You didn't need to. Like, it might have been better if I had known all of what you just said. But like, as a first time, you know, ignorant viewer, you didn't need to.
No, that was why it was such a great episode. It was so well written and so well. Everything that was in it related to the TV show and did a great job. You know, like Sister Knight paints the line across her eyes, but he paints the white line across, you know, like all the, they did all the echoing motifs within the episode. And the writer was a guy named Cord Jefferson, who also worked on The Good Place and did some other things. And he apparently was not like a huge Watchmen fan either. He read Watchmen when he was brought onto the project. So it makes sense that it would be accessible, but I will say that like, I think a big part of the impact for me was what it does going backwards. And I really enjoy when a later piece of work can that dramatically affect an earlier piece of work. I think that's such a cool thing that so rarely happens.
Was Hooded Justice gay in the graphic novel?
Okay, so the graphic novel, the short answer, kind of. Longer answer, we don't know. Longest answer, graphic novel set in 86, and Hooded Justice's stuff is part of the sort of flashback to the previous existence of these people back in whatever it was. I guess it's the... my timeline's brain down. I guess it's the 40s or the 50s, whatever it was that they were active. And so Hooded Justice is a total background character. He has probably 10 lines of dialogue. Each issue of the comic had some stuff at the back that was like in-world materials that were supplemental to it, like essays or articles or whatever, to sort of build out the universe. And there was some mention of him in there. And the suspicion is raised that he is gay, that he is communist, that he is a German bodybuilder who is like hiding out because he doesn't want to reveal that he's German. There's all these sort of...
There's a lot of stuff going on there.
Yeah, whole bunch of stuff going on. But none
of it's answered. I just mentioned because just viewing the series, that was one of the kind of head scratchers was, and maybe it was only contained within that Hooded Justice episode. It was like episode 5, maybe 6. I don't know.
That's what it was.
Was like kind of like these flashes after Regina King takes the nostalgia pills, flashes of like him having gay sex with that other, what do you call him? Masked man.
Yeah. Captain Metropolis or whatever his name is.
Captain Metropolis. Yeah. Yes. I can never remember. Yeah. It was like, and that just felt really out of place and kind of like not in service of this story. That just felt off, and I was wondering if I was missing something.
I think the rumors that are written in the back of the comic imply that there was a relationship between a gay relationship between Hooded Justice and Captain Metropolis. I don't remember how explicit it is. If we do have anyone listening who is a big fan of the work, they're yelling at the phone right now, and I apologize. I can't remember. But what I do know is that he appears in the comics as what appears to be a white man wearing an executioner's hood with a noose around his neck. And it's like, you look at the way they explain that in the episode, that is that, Reeves was threatened, was lynched in a threatening way and then cut down as a sort of warning, wearing a hood with a noose around his neck. And you look at the iconography and you're like, oh my God, this like makes so much sense. It feels like what they must have intended, even though they clearly, there's no way on earth that they intended it. It was a really well executed using of what was there. Now the gay relationship maybe was a little clumsier, but I don't know. It was really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there just wasn't a lot of sex in this series. I mean, it just felt like out of place. I don't know. It was just like, I felt like it was telling me something that I wasn't like understanding.
Well, the movie version of Watchmen has what my wife considers to be arguably the worst sex scene she's ever seen in a movie ever, which is scored by Leonard Cohen's original version of Hallelujah and is just awful. I mean, it's really, it's really bad. You should.
Speaking of the score, the music was awesome in this series. There was like several instances of me like Shazamming different songs, you know, because like each episode with a song, there was a lot of like scoring with like older kind of like almost like old timey music, especially when you're like during the nostalgia trips that I didn't really. Wasn't familiar with, and like the lyrics were often very, you know, kind of like telling the story. And actually part of why I love the open so much is when it goes from Tulsa 1921 to Tulsa Now, and it's the white dude in the pickup truck like blasting Future. It's the song Crushed Up by Future. It's just like so awesome. It's like a perfect choice. Yeah, I just really enjoyed the music, and as the real Mr. Irrelevant podcast heads know, they know that we're, you know, we appreciate fine soundtracks.
Well, so one of the best parts about the soundtrack here is they used the soundtrack as kind of that extra material that I was talking about, not the songs that actually exist in you know, already exist in our world, but the Trent Reznor soundtrack comes with like all of these reviews and articles about how Trent Reznor used to be in the band Pale Horse, which is the band that was playing in Madison Square Garden the night that the squid dropped, and this, that. There's a whole sort of like ARG kind of, you know, alternate reality game kind of experience to reading the soundtrack and everything else. I have not engaged with that part that much, but I will say that the soundtrack is now one of my favorite things. Like if I'm just trying to get work done or whatever, you put on the first of the Trent Reznor soundtrack albums, like None with a Motherfucking Gun. And it just goes, it's so good.
All right. I'll take that as a tip. It was also strange watching it now in June, 2020, you know, with all of the protests and racial injustice, systemic racism is like on everyone's mind. And to be watching this story that's so much about the, you know, white supremacists that are in power but aren't overtly racist, aren't overtly committing these acts of terror, but it's happening, you know, over the history of you know, this country, or at least like the history of this timeline that goes back 80 or 100 years. It really was kind of unsettling to watch that now, because it's unsettling because when I'm watching things like, for example, that, you know, the NASCAR scene on Monday with Bubba Wallace, and, you know, after a noose had been found in his garage, and, you know, in hindsight, maybe it was there to begin with and not necessarily intended for him, but whatever, there was a noose in the garage. All of the drivers and all the crew people, like, they pushed his car out. And he posts this selfie that everybody's seen by now of him holding his phone up, and he's in the foreground, and behind him is just like hundreds of white men in masks. And like, to see that scene, I can't like decouple like what I just watched in The Watchmen from that moment. And, you know, it just added a layer to current events that, you know, maybe I missed out on all of the kind of conversation around the show, but I do think it's particularly rich to be watching it now.
It was. And so why, having just rewatched it now after having watched it then, mm-hmm. the weirdest part was actually not the race part, which has seemed weird in retrospect mm-hmm. since it happened. Come back to that in a second. But the weirdest part for me was the masks, because the first viewing, you know, when it first aired, the masks are just like this weird, creepy thing. Like, why are the cops in masks? And you eventually understand what the in-story reason is and whatever. But you watch it now, and it's all these people. There's all these like little gestures they do where they like pull the mask up or pull it down or adjust it. And it's things that you see people doing now in real life all the time. But mm-hmm. this predates that, you know, in creation by whatever, 9 months or a year or whatever, however long it took to make. And it's just, it's a bit of iconography that has totally changed its relevance in the time since. One other note quickly on the, you know, you talked about the opening 10 minutes of the show and going back 100 years and the racism issue. The number of people, myself included, who were completely unfamiliar with the Tulsa Massacre, when the show opens, there were a lot of people who thought that that was part of the alternate timeline. And even people who were aware of the existence of the Tulsa Massacre were like, oh, well, I mean, they're using planes against them. That must be, you know, made up and must be like the alternate world of the show. And so there was this really weird spate of people suddenly being like, oh my God, like I had no idea about this incredibly awful part of American history. So I feel like there were certain people who were primed for what's going on now actually by the show airing. I think there's a direct correlation there.
Right. Yeah. And I was trying to remember, because I definitely learned of that event just in recent years, and maybe just in the recent year. I can't remember if it kind of, I became aware because of the show and all the attention that it drew to it, or if it was independently of that.
But
that does seem to be like the prime example of like, here's something that we weren't taught. Like here's you know, our version of American history that like we were taught in schools needs to, you know, be revised, and here's like the primary example of what needs to be included in that curriculum.
The I believe Lindelof learned about it by reading Ta-Nehisi Coates either an essay or one of his books. So I mean, it's sort of spread somewhat to the sort of circles who actually read things at that point. I obviously was not among those at the time, but it was the reason he wanted to make this. When people would ask him after the fact, you know, with the whole rights issue and the moral question, you claim you love this comic and you love the creators, why would you do this thing that goes against the wishes of the creator of the comic? And he was like, I found something that I wanted to get out there. And if I had made a Tulsa Massacre show about race, you know, nobody would have watched it and nobody would have cared.
Right.
So he Trojan horsed it into the Watchmen concept and made it the core of it.
Incredible.
And it was
incredible.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was
just, I mean, so I live in Wilmington, North Carolina, and if you look at the headlines today, there's a story from Wilmington, North Carolina that I don't even want to talk about.
Yep.
But like the coup of 1898 happened in Wilmington, where white supremacists overthrew the government here. And at the time, Wilmington was like 65-70% black. I think 50-60 people were murdered that day, driven out of town. White supremacists took over the government. Today, Wilmington is like 15% black. People that live here don't know about that. Like that's probably like the next horrible, like racist, you know, like domestic terrorist event that's probably going to be hopefully somehow like brought to light and become more, you know, familiar to people. But like just last night, two Confederate statues came down in Wilmington, and they were taken down by the government because people, the streets were going to take them down anyway. Those monuments were erected by the organizers of the coup of 1898, and they still stood over our streets here in Wilmington. Our elementary school that our kids go to is named after Walter J. Parsley, who is one of the primary organizers of the coup of 1898. That elementary school that I sent my kids to wasn't named for that white supremacist motherfucker until like 1999.
Well,
so
when you have
it, it's just like, man, it is.
When you have an imposing name like Parsley, how can you pass it up regardless of the connotations?
So I don't know, like this show, and obviously these times, just conjured a lot of stuff that I think needs to be reckoned with. It was interesting to be watching it now in this context. And there was a couple of different lines that really resonated. One was the villainous senator guy who says, masks save lives at one point.
Yep.
And I was like, man, put that kind of billboard. And then the other one was near the end, Will Reeves, played by Louis Gossett Jr., which I thought was just one amazing of many like awesome casting choices.
Amazing.
He says, wounds need air.
You can't heal under a mask, I think is the first part of it. Yeah, totally. It lands so weirdly now. And the defense of the character, Don Johnson's character, having the Klan robe literally in his closet, is part of his heritage. I mean, the whole thing, some of it seemed, it's funny, it's only been what, 6 months since, I think the finale was in December or January. Yeah. Like it's been 6 months. There were things in there like that seemed a little on the nose, and now I'm like, oh wait, no, that was 1,000% accurate. And the whole concept in it that they sort of focus on more in the first two episodes, but then kind of drop, of the Redfordations, the idea of being that Robert Redford has, who is the president in this timeline, has elected to give reparations to the survivors, or the descendants of people killed in the Tulsa Massacre. And like, you know, there's all this resentment of people getting Redfordations and this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. And in the last week, I mean, the topic of reparations has come up very seriously among like, not just lunatic, people writing science fiction or whatever, or crazy,
I think there's a New York Times Magazine cover story that I think is just out online today. It's like a 40-minute read. I saved it to my pocket.
I look forward to getting to it in 2029 when I finally catch up with my pocket reading.
No, I mean, to your point though. Yeah, I mean,
it's really weird. The whole thing lands really weird.
Yeah, man. Well, I would recommend it to anyone. I would actually say I should have done this long ago. I should have just subscribed to HBO to watch The Watchmen.
So the other thing I will say, this is a very, very, it's like an inside baseball. It's like a reference to a conversation that you and I had years ago. Mm-hmm. Your description of watching this is the best argument I've ever heard for that stupid structure of a TV commentary site that I've ever heard. Like, there needs to be a way people watching after the fact to get at least a shadow of the experience of watching along without worry of spoilers or anything else.
Because you can't, after I didn't want anything to get spoiled, and then after I watched it, the only thing I could really consume was like the stuff that had came out that had come out after the finale, because everything else is just too comprehensive, and like I don't want to read like I don't want to listen to like a podcast about episode two that doesn't like address or like acknowledge what happened in episodes 3 through 9,
So the ones I will say that are probably worth digging up is the 3 episodes of the official one, because they did it for episodes 1 through 3, episode 4 through 6, and then the last 3 episodes.
So there's an official Watchmen pod.
Yeah,
that's like three parts.
Yeah, and it's Lindelof and the sort of MC host kind of guy is Craig Mazin, who was one of the writers on Chernobyl and does the Script Notes podcast. So like, it's a very polished, good podcast. It's not particularly clumsy. Then there was an episode of the Twin Peaks podcast, a podcast about Twin Peaks, where one of the hosts of that is Jeff Jensen, who was a former Entertainment Weekly writer. He was one of the big early like Lost superfan writers. He went on, after being a writer about Lost, to co-write Tomorrowland with Damon Lindelof. So he was one of the writers on Watchmen, and he was the co-writer on the Dr. Manhattan Unstuck in Time episode. So on this podcast that he used to do about Twin Peaks, they brought it back to do an episode where they instead talked to him about Watchmen. That one is pretty good because it's just focused on that one episode and on sort of the nuts and bolts of the creation of the show. And I think it's probably like Jensen, as you would expect from that resume, is a super nerd. And I say that with all the love in the world. So I don't think, though, that it goes super comics-y. I think it sticks mostly to like the TV elements of it. Those are ones that I would recommend if you're only going to do like 4 of them.
By the way, with regard to Lindelof, like I watched all of Lost and loved Lost, and that was probably like the first show that I even cared to like read about and learn about and hunt for Easter eggs about, like loved Lost, watched all of Leftovers and enjoyed it, but not really on the level. I didn't feel like, I needed more Leftovers in my life other than just watching the show. It was very bleak. This one, I mean, this is return him to like king status.
Yeah,
including Leftovers. Leftovers isn't even a strike against him, but like all 3 shows are pretty great. And is he just 3 for 3? Like, I don't even know what else he's done.
Everything else, he's 3 for 3 on his sort of big signature TV series. He came up as like a writer on like The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. The Don Johnson one, because that's how Don Johnson, what's it called?
Oh,
Nash Bridges. Yeah. He came up as
Don
like,
Johnson was great, by the way.
Yeah,
in this, he was only in it, I guess, one episode.
Don Johnson really making a good name for himself in 2019 playing racists, as I finally watched Knives Out the other night. In which Don Johnson plays a racist.
Yeah, I watched that the other night too. Heavy dose of Don Johnson.
I have not yet seen the second season of The Leftovers. I found the first season so bleak that even though it was good, I just couldn't do it. So I need to go back to that. He did Tomorrowland, I think, is the only movie that he sort of takes full on ownership of. I like it a lot. Nobody else does. There's like no critical groundswell for it. There's no like secret fan community for it. I like George Clooney. I like Damon Lindelof. I like Jeff Jensen. It's fun. It's a nice movie. I like it.
I don't even know what Tomorrowland is. It sounds vaguely familiar.
I think it's, I guess you would consider it a YA movie. It's about sort of the idea of like what, where did the future go wrong? You know, the Tomorrowland in Disney World is, you know, this sort of 50s vision of the future. And why didn't we get
the shittiest part of Disney World?
Yes. Oh, it absolutely is.
Out of all of the different lands.
But much like Pirates of the Caribbean, making a shockingly successful transition to a first movie, let's not speak about the rest of them.
At least that's a good ride.
Have you been on it recently? It's kind of okay.
It's kind of okay. But yeah, I remember loving it as a kid, and like my kids loved it.
Tomorrowland is good in that it's watchable. It goes fast. There's some good set pieces. It looks nice. I will watch Clooney read the phone book, and it's family friendly. So it's one that, you know, when it's your pick for family movie night, you could conceivably choose to throw on.
My big note for Lindelof on this one is instead of Tomorrowland, let's do Space Mountain.
Oh yeah, that would be great. And I feel like he's really dug himself a hole with Watchmen, because now if he does Space Mountain, we'll expect it to be like, you know, a groundbreaking exploration of the tragic extermination of the native population in America, as seen through the lens of Space Mountain. And right. We'll just be disappointed if it's not.
By the way, I somehow we made it through this whole thing without talking at all about like wherever, like whatever, like ring of Jupiter or what's his name, like Ozymandias?
Yeah. Ozymandias, yep.
Voight.
Yep. You're doing great, Veidt, man.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, wherever he was, I mean, that was deeply weird and surreal for like a long time before it kind of becomes, especially as someone like me who had no idea who that was, before that was revealed. Like that also as a like, you know, newbie to this world and as a viewer of the series, I could have spent less time there.
Yeah. Every time we, on our rewatch, every time they cut to him, I would doze off. And my wife was like, don't you want to watch this show? I thought you were all excited about it. She's like, you've fallen asleep on every episode. I'm like, no, I only fall asleep when we go to that part. Like, it's fine. Just make sure I wake back up for the rest of it. Yeah. It's, there are flaws. There are no doubt flaws. And that is the biggest
one. Was rewarding that like you kind of, in the end, you understand where he was and like how he kind of comes back to Earth, literally, is interesting. And kind of, I feel like they that all tied up, you know, that all kind of came together. But I mean, I felt like we spent an hour there just wondering what the fuck.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really necessary.
But it felt to me like they had, and I may have heard one of them say this somewhere, mm-hmm. but either way, it felt to me like they had a week of time at whatever that castle was, and they had Jeremy Irons for like 1 week there and then like 5 days on the regular shoot, and they were like, well, let's see what we can do with this, and that's what they came up with, mm-hmm. or something, because yeah, it had flaws. We also, I mean, we haven't mentioned I thought Tim Blake Nelson was like amazing. I liked his character. I liked his, you know, him doing
it. Looking Glass in the graphic novel?
No.
So Looking Glass and Sister Night, or whatever her name was, were not in the graphic novel.
Correct. Now, Looking Glass, a lot of his sort of affectations are modeled after Rorschach, who was, it's the masks that the guys, that the cavalry wears in this, are based on a character who was in the graphic novel, only they have, you know, sort of taken his ideology off into the extreme, and, you know, some would argue they haven't understood.
Was Rorschach even in this?
No, he.
Okay, because I've heard that name maybe just from reading or listening after the fact.
He's the one who's played by Jackie Earle Haley in the movie version. He's the character who, like, when you read it and you're 17, and especially if you are a 17-year-old boy, you come away thinking, like, that guy, man, he's cool. He had some ideas, and they just didn't understand him. Mm-hmm. And then when you read it, like, at any time after, say, 5 years after that, you're like, oh, well, he's, like, an awful human being and, you know, troubled man and just terrible. But the number of people who never really make that turn and realize that is troubling. He's the sort of character for Watchmen.
Who are the other two? There were two other cops.
Yeah, it's
along with Looking Glass and Sister Night, who were like masked.
Yeah, they were also new. It was Red Scare is the Russian guy, and I believe Pirate Jenny is the name of the pirate lady.
Man,
they're
yeah. Like, I didn't have a whole lot of use for them. I was kind of wondering like who they were, other than just, you know, cops with interesting costumes.
Yeah, they're just cops with interesting costumes. The other one is that we see is Panda, who is the one who's like on dispatch and wears like dirty panda head.
Big panda head, yeah.
I have no idea what that's about. Now, Lori, the detective, who I'm forgetting the name of the actress.
FBI.
Yeah, she is a character from Watchmen. She's actually her father is the one who was killed. That sets off the whole murder mystery. Only you don't know in the show that it's, or in the story, that it's her father. That's not revealed until much later. And that is actually the first thing that's that Dr. Manhattan references as being a thermodynamic miracle, is the fact that even though the guy who was Lori's father, like, raped and sexually abused the woman who's Lori's mother, they wound up getting together anyway, and he views this as like this weird quirk of humanity that he calls a thermodynamic miracle. That, what I mean, doesn't matter, but point is, she was there, Vite was there, I feel like there's one more that I'm forgetting. Dr. Manhattan obviously was there.
I did like that Dr. Manhattan was like under our noses the whole time, and I had no idea. Like, I didn't pick up any sort of like, oh, Sister Knight's husband is a key figure. Like, I didn't pick up a scent on that until basically it was, you know, apparent.
Yeah, no, I did not either. And I loved that twist. Also, we should really take at least 1 second and say that Regina King is amazing.
Awesome. That's part of why I love the ending so much. Is like, you know, that it was like she had all the power. And she was like the actress and character that you were, you know, kind of, I don't know, maybe I haven't really thought this through, but like, she was like the one that everyone was kind of, you could find themselves pulling for the whole time.
Yes. It was great. It was a great ending. It was a great mm-hmm. performance. I'm totally with you on that.
Mm-hmm. I love that image of, you know, like, she, you know, cracks the egg and like, you just close up on her foot and stepping out on the water. Like, that's a great final image.
Yes, I agree. And it was funny. That was one where Lindelof, on at least one of his appearances somewhere, was like, people keep asking me about the ambiguous ending. He's like, it's not ambiguous. If she falls into the pool, that's a stupid ending to that story.
I don't even want to consider that. It's also stupid. It's like, okay, what, you like let her take a few steps and then you cut?
Yeah.
You
know? Like,
I have a question. If you had an egg that had like infinite powers, if you just consumed this egg, this yolk, would you just crack it with your bare hands?
I'm not gonna lie,
not like on the rim of a bowl or a pan or, you know, countertop or something.
Well, I mean, and I've been giving thought to is like, I'd be like, well, do I think the powers will still be there if I, for example, made this into like an omelet or something a little more appealing than just cracking the egg straight down my throat?
Yeah, if I fried this egg, would it still transfer the power?
What if I made some like fried rice and scrambled this egg and stirred it into the fried rice? Would that work?
But seriously, I guess it wouldn't have been as cool if she like cracked it in the kitchen or whatever, but I'm sitting there thinking like, this is a priceless treasure. You do not want that to like hit the deck.
Yeah.
And you're just going to crack it open with your, I'm not sure if I could crack an egg open with my bare hands. Like, you know, I feel like there's like a decent chance, like a 40% chance that yolk's going to hit the ground.
That's one of the reasons she's a much more impressive character than either of us.
How many takes did that take? Do you think she nailed it?
It's interesting that you say that too, because like one of the things about her is that I felt like she nailed everything. Like I'm sure there was a lot of effort that went into the performance. I'm sure everything had multiple takes because that's how life works. But like,
it seemed effortless.
She just looked effortless up there. It was really, I was really impressed with her. Throughout.
It was, yeah. Like whether she was like a supreme badass, like beating the shit out of people, or like, you know, teaching a class or like having sex with her husband or whatever, like, or in peril. Like it was always like completely convincing.
Yes, it really was. I don't know. I just, you know, back to my thing, was it the greatest show or not? You know, which I'm sure I said, I just feel like it's one of the best acted. It's one of the best, you know, looking, it's one of the best written. It's certainly everybody involved is really, you know, really, you know, locked in and mm-hmm. doing some of their best work. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm a fan. What can I say?
Well, I will say in conclusion, thank you, because I don't think I would have watched this if you hadn't lavished so much praise on it last fall.
Well,
I didn't really have other people in my life telling me to watch the show.
Well, that makes me feel better.
Which says a lot about my friends. I don't know. but yeah, like you were probably like you were the Watchmen presence in my life.
Well, you can always rely on your doughiest friend to recommend the geeky TV show. You can count on that.
Do we have any reason to convene anytime soon? I'm trying to think of like...
If there's a football season.
I seriously doubt it.
I just don't see how it can happen. I know everybody's determined to like just sort of will it into existence. I just don't see how it can happen. But I mean, do you want to do, since we're talking about systemic racism, do we want to say anything about the George Preston Marshall thing at this late date?
I was like unaware of that there was like a George Preston Marshall statue. Like I wasn't really aware of the Marshall presence. In modern times, I hadn't heard that name in a long time.
Well, it never fully registered for me. Like I knew George Preston Marshall was racist, he's not one where like, if you met somebody whose name was George Marshall, you would not be like, "Ooh, awkward associations." The way you would if you met somebody whose name was like Adolf Hitler, you'd be like, "Oh, that's rough, buddy."
Right.
But I applaud them for taking down the statue. I applaud them for renaming the lower bowl. I applaud them for choosing Bobby Mitchell as the person to rename it over, although kind of wish he had been alive to see it. That seems a little unfortunate. I kind of take issue with them removing him from the history wall and removing all reference to his name. Like, that's not the lesson that I think we're trying to learn here. The lesson is that these racists did exist. This has been ingrained forever. This is part of the system and part of the history, and we're going to do better. We're not going to pretend that it never happened. I find it a little troubling, you know?
Ignorance is bliss.
Yep.
Yeah, there's a difference between maybe like not honoring these monsters of the past with statues and then also like ignoring them in the record books, or not record books, but just on the record.
Yep. Well said. That's what I keep thinking.
Did you know I went to George Marshall High School?
I did not.
So Marshall High is in Falls Church, Virginia, but it's named after General George Catlett Marshall. George C. Marshall. You may remember him from the movie Saving Private Ryan. He has a wonderful reading of the letter that kind of explains the situation about this private who's lost his brothers and he doesn't know it yet. That's George.
I had no idea. Marshall. I've learned something about local history today on top of everything else.
That's right. Marshall baseball forever.
That's what I always say, man. Marshall baseball forever.
Okay. Well, fuck George Preston Marshall and, you know, praise to George Catlett Marshall.
I'm comfortable with leaving on that note.
Honestly, I don't really know anything about George Catlett Marshall.
Pause. Quick Googling first.
He was a general in World War II. I know that.
Well, World War II means there's at least a reasonable chance that he was not an actual Confederate general. So that's good.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I don't know, man. Like, you know, this stuff is generational.
All right. We're going to walk back our favorable comments on George Catlett Marshall pending further research. We're going to reserve the right to walk that.
The man wrote a hell of a letter. Actually, no, he didn't even write the letter. I don't think he might have just read it. Anyway. Okay, man. It was great talking to you.
Good talking to you. We'll talk again when there's football in 2023.
Okay. See you.
Bye.